ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas. Welcome. We are diving into the world of the very, very small today, but it's big in possibility, and we're about to find out why. Australian physicist Professor Michelle Simmons is making waves globally in what's called quantum computing. Now, what is that? I'm a science journalist and I'm still working it out, to be honest. And over the next two episodes of Big Ideas, a chance to learn stuff to impress your friends with, but also to help you understand the future we are hurtling towards, the space race of the computing era. To build a machine more powerful than all the computers in the world combined, one that operates at the quantum level, at the level of individual atoms. How does that actually work and what could it achieve for us? Is it all just a distant dream or could Australia, yes, Australia, be on the cusp of a world first? This is the ABC's recent Boyer Lectures, four lectures combined into two action-packed editions of Big Ideas. He's former Australian of the Year, the 2023 recipient of the Prime Minister's Prize for Science and the 2023 Boyer Lecturer, Professor Michelle Simmons, with part one, The Atomic Revolution.
In the Science Museum in London, there is part of a 19th century mechanical calculating machine termed the analytical engine, dreamed up by the British computing pioneer Charles Babbage. Made of brass, bronze, steel and wood, it looks like a component from a weaver's loom, hocked from an old textile factory. It certainly doesn't look anything like a modern-day computer, and, at roughly a metre cubed, and this was only a trial piece for a much larger machine, it is a quaint reminder not only of how far we've come, but also of how our technologies scale over time. There is an even more fascinating computer in the Science Works Museum in Melbourne. This is the famous CIRAC computer, built by Trevor Pearcey and his Australian team in the 1940s. This computer was state-of-the-art in its day. Made using 2,000 vacuum tubes, that period's version of our modern transistors, each big enough to hold in your hand, and stacked together in banks, the machine filled an entire room. And I know I'm not the first to point out the contrast with our modern calculating machines, but it is astonishing in comparison to think that the current Apple M1 Mac chip, manufactured by TSMC, manages to fit 57 billion transistors onto one slither of an object about the size of an after-dinner mint. Computers are not the only technology that has shrunk over time. The first motors were enormous, big, bulky, steam-powered machines, originally designed to pump water out of mines. Now you can find miniature electronic motors all over the place, in refrigerators, dishwashers, vacuum cleaners, cameras, and of course in an ever-expanding range of transportation technologies. The first mechanical clocks were also rather grand and expensive, so much so that the earliest mechanical chronometers were only ever to be found in significant public places like churches, cathedrals, and town halls. Today, anyone can buy a watch, and our whole world has become synchronized as a result. Or think about printers. Gutenberg's printing press was twice as high as a man, larger than a grand piano, and arduous to use. Yet now you can pick up an efficient laser printer from Officeworks that you can carry in both hands. The miniaturization of computing, then, is not an entirely unique story. One of the ways humans can enhance any technology is to try to miniaturize it. It is not uncommon that, having made something smaller, we find new uses for it, which end up transforming society in unanticipated ways. The story of computing is unique, however, in scale, if not in kind. And I say this not just because of the stark comparison that might be drawn between Charles Babbage's effort and the iPhone, or between the CIRAC of the late 1940s and the wild multitude of conveniently sized and extremely powerful computing devices we all have at our disposal today. What sets computing apart from other technologies that we have miniaturized is the speed and the scale of miniaturization, and the unbelievable fact, as I will explain, that we have now brought this particular process to its ultimate limit, whereby the core features of our computing machinery can be reduced to the size of individual atoms. Today, I'm going to tell you the story of how this happened and why it matters. It is a story that links fundamental physics, extraordinary technological advancements, and the future of computing. It is also largely an Australian story. And it starts with two things you may not often hear about on the radio: the transistor and the atom. The foundation of all modern computers is the transistor, which was invented back in 1947. That probably feels like a long time ago, but in historical terms, it is very recent. Indeed, it is remarkable to think that throughout the most of human history, there was no such thing as a transistor. Yet the transistor has become the core calculating component at the heart of every computer, mobile phone, and smart device on the planet. Transistors are electronic devices that act as switches, embodying the ones and zeros of the digital age. They increasingly run the world. Microprocessors contain billions of transistors, and most of us use trillions every day without giving it a moment's thought. These are the elemental gears that run our digital economy. They are all pervasive, inescapable even, in the modern world. Yet they are now also so small as to be imperceptible. The person whose name will forever be associated with the process of miniaturization in computing is Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel. He's the one who first noted that the number of transistors on a microchip was roughly doubling every 18 months to 2 years, which essentially meant that transistors were halving in size over the same time frame. Moore published his data in the 1960s and projected the rate of growth into the future, observing that if any semiconductor company wanted to remain competitive over time, it would have to keep cramming more and more transistors into less and less space. In doing so, he set a standard known as Moore's Law that the entire industry strove for, and turned what was then just an observation of a few years of data into a self-fulfilling prophecy that has spanned decades. In the late 1990s, when I was working in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge and considering migrating to Australia, I remember looking at this data and wondering about the forward projection. Back then, judging by the speed at which the semiconductor industry was innovating, it looked as if it would only be about 20 years, i.e. the early 2020s, when we would be working at the atomic scale. To understand what a breathtaking thought this was, and why I found it such an exciting prospect, you should know something more about the atom. The first person that we know of to speculate about the existence of atoms was the Greek philosopher Democritus. In 460 BC, he asked a simple question: if you break something in half, and then in half again, how small would the pieces eventually become? He theorized that at some point you would end up with the smallest part of matter, which he called the atom. Unfortunately for Democritus, experimental science was not particularly advanced in 460 BC. And to make matters worse, Aristotle, who was much more influential as a philosopher, didn't like the theory. So no one paid much attention to the idea for about 2,000 years. The atom is not the smallest unit of nature, for atoms themselves are made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons. But atoms are nature's building blocks. All the material that surrounds us, including the earth on which we walk, the food we eat, and our very own bodies, are composed of atoms. And if most humans in history have had no concept of their existence, this is hardly surprising, because atoms are unimaginably small. A single atom is about 10 billionths of a meter, or about 50,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. It should not surprise you then to know that even in the late 90s, the idea of making transistors and other electronic devices with components made of individual atoms seemed a little far-fetched. In those days, despite the 20-year predictions from Moore's Law, there was no known technology for making things on such a scale. But I was keen on the idea. To make electronic devices out of individual atoms, that was something almost unimaginable, an idea truly at the forefront of possibility. And I liked that, not just because I like a challenge, but because in science, it is at the frontiers that the greatest discoveries are made. At the Cavendish, I was already trying to see if I could make the fastest, most perfect transistors. However, I found that as these devices got smaller and smaller, they became harder and harder to reproduce. I liken it to a sculptor trying to make an exquisitely carved statue. The tools we were using to make these devices, tools that were even more advanced than the semiconductor industry was using, were still just too blunt. Working at the atomic scale meant forging a different path. It meant doing something that no one else had ever done before. In some ways, back then, it was like saying you were going to walk on the moon. It also meant accessing the quantum world, the mysterious world of the very small, where the laws of nature take on completely counterintuitive and wonderfully powerful properties. But how to manage it? Fortunately, a new kind of microscope had been invented in the 1980s, the scanning tunneling microscope, which allowed us for the first time to see individual atoms. This microscope works by bringing a very fine metal tip down to a surface under vacuum. When it gets close to the surface, a tiny current begins to flow from the tip to the atoms. Electrons essentially tunnel from the tip to the atom, hence the term tunneling microscope. If we scan this tip across the atoms, keeping the current constant, we essentially get a height profile of the atoms on the surface. Using this microscope for the first time, it became possible to build up a three-dimensional image of all the atoms on the surface. This is an awe-inspiring tool, and widely recognized as such. The scanning tunneling microscope was one of the fastest discoveries ever to win the Nobel Prize, receiving the award in 1984, just 4 years after it was invented. But it turned out to be possible to go a step further. In 1990, IBM researchers in Switzerland tried something highly imaginative. Instead of just using this very special microscope to look at atoms on a surface, they applied voltages to pick atoms up and move them around, famously arranging 35 atoms on a metal surface to spell IBM, making the world's smallest logo. This was the idea that captured my imagination, but it was a long way from being a perfected tool, for whilst it was easy enough to use this microscope to pick up the atoms on a metal surface, it is a very different thing to manipulate atoms inside a semiconductor crystal, where the chemical bonding presents a far stronger impediment. Nevertheless, I'd seen some recent papers of how this might be done and had some ideas of my own. In 1999, I decided I would come to Australia and see if I could adapt this imaging and manipulation tool to build electronic devices in silicon at the atomic scale, rather than making devices smaller and smaller each year as industry was doing. I was determined to leapfrog Moore's law and to push straight for the endpoint to make devices with atomic precision. Now, at that time, conventional transistors were being made with feature sizes of 200 nanometers, which is equivalent to about 1,000 atoms across. And every integrated circuit was being made up from a complex mixture of atoms with elements from nearly two-thirds of the periodic table, from silicon to aluminium, tungsten, copper, and many complex oxides. My plan was to build functional devices in silicon at the atomic scale, so 1,000 times smaller, and made out of just two elements, silicon and phosphorus. We knew that the scanning tunneling microscope wasn't going to be enough to do this on its own. I knew, and the wider team at UNSW knew, that we had to combine it with another technology, a tool that allowed us to grow perfect crystals of silicon one atomic layer at a time. Yet here's the catch. Up until that point, no one had ever combined these two different technologies. Both had to operate under ultra-high vacuum, the same type of vacuum you find in outer space. But one, the microscope, needed extremely high stability, while the other, the crystal growth tool, used powerful pumps that vibrated almost like a washing machine. They seemed fundamentally incompatible. The consensus view within the scientific community was the chances of combining these two technologies was near impossible. And even if we succeeded on that front, it was pointed out there would be other significant technical challenges to overcome. Indeed, 8 major technical impediments were identified, none of which had been realized before. Even the senior scientists at IBM were skeptical. But we were in Australia, the land of the give-it-a-go attitude. And so, despite the critics, we did it anyway. By 2010, we made what was then the world's smallest transistor, a device constructed out of just 7 phosphorus atoms. In addition to being published in the usual scientific places, this achievement made it into the Guinness Book of World Records, as my son discovered one day to his astonishment while sitting in his school library. Then, in 2011, we showed we could pattern a wire just 1 atom high and 4 atoms wide. We discovered, much to our surprise, and against all theoretical predictions, that it could carry current much as if it had been made of copper. Then, in 2012, we made a transistor where the active part of the device was just a single phosphorus atom, beating those old industry predictions from Moore's Law by nearly a decade. Indeed, Moore's Law has slowed, so the semiconductor industry, even today, has yet to reach this limit. It took us a long time to figure out how to do all this, and to make it happen, we drew on talent from all over the world. In addition to our Australian base, I was fortunate to have great people from many different countries come to help. From Germany, England, Switzerland, the US, Poland, the Netherlands, Singapore, China, Israel, South Korea, and New Zealand, among other places. Even so, it took us 10 years of sustained and systematic problem solving. And of course, we're still refining things. But the approach now is proven, and our laboratories at UNSW and the Sydney manufacturing facilities of our company, Silicon Quantum Computing, now make electronic devices reproducibly at the atomic scale as a matter of routine. Most recently, in 2022, thanks to the efforts of an exceptionally talented team, we reported the creation of the world's first integrated circuit made with atomic precision. An integrated circuit essentially combines multiple device components, such as transistors, onto one integrated chip. We have done this with input and output leads and control gates, all constructed at the atomic scale out of phosphorus and silicon atoms, using our atomic manufacturing process. This incredible piece of engineering came roughly 10 years after we reported designing, engineering, and measuring our single atom transistor, which, curiously, is about the same time it took classical computing to get from the invention of the transistor in 1947 to the creation of the first integrated circuit in 1958. In fact, we've gone beyond the atomic scale. Electrons are subatomic particles that exist on the surface of atoms. They are the fundamental particles that form the physical basis of electricity. I had always believed that if we could control the world with atomic precision, then it would be possible also to manipulate the quantum properties of individual electrons. And in our devices, we can. We can control the movement of individual electrons on and off individual atoms. We can also measure and control the spin properties of these electrons within our devices. The spin of an electron is a property of quantum physics, in which an electron particle acts like a tiny bar magnet. In other words, we now have access to the quantum world. It is my belief that these collective attainments represent the dawn of something truly important. By developing tools to see, organize, control, and measure information using individual atoms, I and those I've worked with have aspired to open a new frontier in electronics, one based upon the intricate control of nature's fundamentals, in which the specific placement of every atom counts. But we've always been aware of a deeper implication, because atoms and their electrons are extremely small and possess quantum properties. Our invention of atomic assembly raises the potential for making a completely new and powerful kind of computer, a quantum computer. A quantum computer is a type of computer that exploits the laws of quantum physics, so that instead of performing calculations sequentially like a conventional computer, it works according to an extreme parallelism, looking at many possible outcomes at the same time and leading to an exponential speed-up in computational power. Quantum computers have the potential to transform nearly every industry, from finance and cryptography to transportation, logistics, machine learning, and even drug design. Little wonder then that today there is an international race to build a quantum computer, and that the leading nations of the world are investing billions, in what has been nicknamed the space race of the computing era. The promise of quantum computing is the subject of my second lecture. But for now, let me say this. Our ability at UNSW to make electronic devices at the level of single atoms has given us a unique opportunity to build a quantum computer here in Australia. We have figured out how to control the placement of individual atoms, the movement of electrons on and off individual atoms, and the spin states of electrons within quantum electronic devices. Australia is at the very forefront of this field, leading the way and backed by a strong patent portfolio. Even today, despite well-funded efforts in other countries, no one else in the world has been able to replicate our process. With the visionary backing of the Australian government, the Commonwealth Bank, Telstra, the New South Wales government, and the University of New South Wales, my team and I are now on a mission to use our atomic assembly technology to build a complete prototype quantum computer for which all the functional elements are manufactured and controlled at the atomic scale. This is not a research project. It is a commercial enterprise. Current estimates suggest that 40% of our economy has the potential to be impacted by quantum computing, and that the global quantum computing opportunity could be worth $150 billion per annum by 2040. To make this work, we have spun a commercial company out of the University of New South Wales called Silicon Quantum Computing. It is an ambitious and entrepreneurial undertaking to scale up what we've done to date, to take all the advantages from 20 years of world-leading Australian research in order to manufacture a new kind of product with the potential to create enormous wealth here in Australia. To find out about that quantum promise, you'll have to tune in next time. But before I leave you, I want to ask one final question. What I've described to you today started out a quarter of a century ago as frontier science, a project to test the bounds of what was technically possible. And we've delivered. Like those who invented the first transistor or the integrated circuit, we have demonstrated a completely new way of doing things. We have shown that it is humanly possible to manipulate atoms into working atomic scale devices. But this isn't just an esoteric accomplishment. It has also given us a novel and extremely powerful manufacturing capability with clear utility and a clear pathway for making a quantum computer. The question is, can we keep a capability like this in Australia? It is sometimes said that we can't manufacture things in this country, that the economics are too difficult. And for certain kinds of products, maybe that's true. Even if Australians had invented the transistor, for example, I'm not sure the technology would have stayed here for very long. In a world without the internet, manufacturers benefited from being close to their customers. And geographically speaking, Australia is an isolated country. And even if that weren't the case, the country would have lacked the specialized workforce needed. But atomic manufacturing is different, and not just because we have a technological lead to begin with, or because we hold key patents and know-how, or because the rest of the world has not been able to catch us. There are other reasons too for expecting that this is a technology that can be industrialized here in Australia. The goal of our company, Silicon Quantum Computing, is to use the fundamental breakthroughs of our atomic revolution, in other words, atomic manufacturing, to build and operate the most precise and highest quality quantum computers. An early error-corrected quantum computer will be an extraordinarily powerful, but also a highly specialized product, manufactured in low volume and at very high margins. Something that does not require the economies of scale of a mass market consumer product. It is also likely that users will access quantum computing as a service via the cloud, rather than owning their own hardware directly. The internet has now eroded the old tyranny of distance, and we have the specialized workforce we need. With more than two decades of Center of Excellence funding from the Australian Research Council, our country's burgeoning quantum startup sector has already attracted a sizable workforce with the ingenuity and skills we need to make this happen. For all these reasons, I believe that this is a technology we can exploit from Australia for Australia. And I'd like to hope that other Australians might share this mindset. It is odd that we ourselves should be made of atoms, and that all the matter we deal with every day is made of atoms. Yet nearly all the humans who've ever existed have not had the slightest notion of these facts. It's only in the last few decades that we've been able to see individual atoms through a microscope. And now we are creating devices at this scale, a scale we didn't know existed for much of human history. Miniaturization has driven technology, and in this country, our researchers have taken it to its extreme limit. We have turned this ability from a lab exercise into a reproducible manufacturing process. And we are now trying to use that manufacturing capability to make computers of extraordinary power. If we succeed in this last step, and in my next lecture, I will explain why I think we will, at the heart of our machines will be components as invisible to the world as the atoms they are made from. Yet they will also prove more consequential than any computer built thus far. Indeed, if we succeed in this last step, everything I've told you today will just be the beginning.
Physicist Professor Michelle Simmons and her first Boyer lecture, The Atomic Revolution. Natasha Mitchell here with you for Big Ideas. Over two episodes, we're bringing you the 2023 Boyer Lectures, starring this Australian global leader in quantum computing. So now we've heard a mini history of miniaturisation and how Australia has found itself at the forefront of quantum computing. Let's join Michelle now to dive into the quantum promise. How does quantum computing work, and who and what industries might benefit from it? This I know I definitely want to understand better.
The computer chip is the defining technology of our era. Computer chips mediate our communications, our commercial and financial transactions, and our storing and sharing of information. They are the chief instruments by which we automate factories, navigate cities, and monitor our environment. They have become the indispensable tools by which we seek to predict the weather, the state of the economy, the price of goods, and even the behavior of others. Our dependence on computer chips has come about with extraordinary speed. The transistor was only invented in 1947, the integrated circuit in 1958. The personal computer was a product of the 70s and 80s. The smartphone has been with us for only about 20 years. It's hard to think of any other technology that has transformed so many parts of human life so quickly and so profoundly. The speed at which computing technology has taken over so many aspects of our lives is due to three key factors. First, it's effective. The transistor, the integrated circuit, and the microprocessor have proved incredibly reliable as information processing tools, tirelessly reproducing the same results, even when performing incredibly complex calculations over countless iterations, including when we drop them on the floor. Second, computing is universal, which is to say, computer chips have come to touch almost every aspect of society, and there's an infinite number of things that can be done with them. Third, computing offers ever-expanding capabilities. This is the effect of Moore's Law over several decades, which has seen an almost unimaginable increase in processing speed and power with each new generation of computing products. The word revolution is overused. We are conditioned by the media, by advertising, and by our own wishful hopes to hype the significance of anything new. For anyone who has lived through the late 20th and early 21st centuries, however, the transistor and the silicon chip are the real deal. They have triggered a genuine and profound revolution that has impacted upon every aspect of society. Now imagine what the world would be like if it were possible to build a new kind of processor that would make even the most powerful supercomputer on the planet today look primitive. This is the promise of quantum computing. A quantum computer is a completely new type of computer, first proposed in the early 1980s, which exploits the laws of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is a branch of physics which deals with nature at very small scales. It is the world of atoms, subatomic particles, and even individual photons of light. For nature's tiniest constituents, things are possible that would be miraculous should they happen to beings as large as you or me. For example, electron spins. they don't spin the way you might imagine, but have a quantum property called spin, which in a magnetic field can take one of two states, spin up or spin down. What's bizarre about quantum particles like electrons, though, is that they can be in a combination of these spin states, so they are some fraction of the spin up state and some fraction of the spin down state at the same time. This is called superposition. Another peculiar feature of the quantum world is that quantum particles, such as electrons, can become correlated with one another, so that whatever happens to one instantaneously and automatically correlates with whatever happens to the other. This happens independent of their separation in space, and this is called entanglement. When two or more particles are entangled, they operate as if they are a single entity, even if they're a universe apart, which is why Einstein referred to the effect as spooky action at a distance. A quantum computer seeks to exploit both these effects to perform a kind of computational magic, enabling massively parallel and incredibly powerful calculations. The basis of this concept is highly mathematical. Well, let me try to explain. In classical computing, all information is reduced to ones and zeros, with each one and each zero corresponding to the on and off states of the current flowing through a transistor. A classical computer works by operating a series of transistors in a logical sequence. Anyone who has written code knows this. You must go from one line to another, providing your computer with a sequential set of instructions. This sequential processing is a fundamental constraint for classical computing. Imagine you have a directory of thousands of telephone numbers and you're trying to locate a single one. If I asked the classical computer where that number is, it would search through the directory, starting at the beginning and working its way to the end. If I wanted to go faster, I could break the problem up. I could split the directory in two and have two computers working. If I wanted to go faster still, I could split the directory in three and use three computers. But fundamentally, in each case, the operation is the same. The basis of computing in the classical world is a sequential, arduous process. Things are very different in the quantum world. A moment ago, I mentioned the mysterious properties of electron spin, superposition, and entanglement. Suspend your disbelief for a moment and imagine I'm in the quantum world and I'm an electron on an atom. The spin of an electron is affected by magnetic fields. If you put me in a magnetic field at low temperature, I'll behave like a little bar magnet. If you place me in the middle of the Earth, I'll either point up to the North Pole, spin up, or down to the South Pole, spin down. These two states are the equivalent of classical bits, are digital ones and zeros of information. Only instead of using the term bits, we use quantum bits or qubits. So far, there's not a lot of difference between a classical bit and a quantum bit. The former has ones and zeros, the latter can be spin up or spin down. But the difference in terminology is significant because a quantum bit can do things a classical bit simply cannot. You'll remember that in addition to being spin up or spin down, i.e. one or zero, an electron can also exist in a superposition of states. It can be in some fraction of the up state and some fraction of the down state at the same time. If we go back to imagining our electron as a little bar magnet in the center of the Earth, this means that instead of just pointing to the North or South Pole, it can point anywhere on the surface of the Earth, to London, New York, Sydney, or even Quito in Ecuador, which exists almost exactly at the equator. So, exactly halfway in between. The direction of this little bar magnet, or the superposition state of one quantum bit, can be described mathematically using two classical bits of information, one describing the fraction of the up state and the other describing the fraction of the down state. So, already you can see that a quantum bit contains double the amount of information than a classical bit. Now consider what happens when I bring two electrons together so they become entangled. Each electron can either be spin up or spin down, or a superposition of both states. That means that the two entangled electrons can be in four possible spin states: up, up, down, down, up, down, or down, up. We are no longer constrained to ones and zeros. Every time I add a quantum bit to my system, I'm doubling the amount of information it contains. That is very different from the situation with a classical computer. This is not the only advantage, however. You'll recall that entanglement results in my electrons, or my quantum bits, functioning as if they were a single entity. This means that if I do any operation on this combined state, I do it on all the individual components at the same time. This makes quantum computing intrinsically parallel and amazingly powerful, in a way that classical computing can never be. The implications are profound. The power of doubling means that by the time you get to 50 quantum bits, there are tasks for which your quantum computer will outperform the world's most powerful supercomputer. And if we get to several hundred quantum bits, all operating with low errors, it's been predicted you'd have something more powerful than all the computers in the world connected together. That's a pretty extraordinary prize. And this is one of the reasons why there are many teams across the world racing to try and build one. So how will quantum computing change the world? If someone had tried to answer that question in 1947 about the transistor, they would have been wildly wrong. Back then, it was impossible to see how these funny little on-off switches would eventually shake the world, with their first uses being in hearing aids, calculators, and transistor radios. I'm sure the same is true for quantum computers. Having a capacity more powerful than all the computers of the world combined will generate opportunities and applications that are currently unimaginable, at least for someone of my abilities. However, there is a key difference between the two eras, which makes some crystal ball gazing possible for quantum computing, at least in the near term. Whereas the transistor emerged as a novel form of hardware looking for its applications, in the quantum field, there are already huge numbers of software engineers and algorithm developers working on quantum problems even before the hardware has been built. Already, more than 60 algorithms have been dreamed up that could be run on quantum computers to solve problems in areas like logistics, search optimization, machine learning, financial market analysis, catalyst design, drug design, aircraft design, supply chain management, and cryptography, to name just a few. To elaborate on one example, current drug discovery processes have notoriously high costs and high failure rates. One of the critical impediments in this regard is that classical computers, even the most powerful supercomputers in the world, have intrinsic limitations when it comes to modeling drug structures and biological interactions. That's because the quantum mechanical properties of drugs, such as the way electrons behave within a drug molecule, or the ways drugs interact with an organism's biology, are often too complex for a classical computer to calculate. Yet these kinds of calculations lend themselves to simulation on a quantum computer. Indeed, the use of quantum computing for molecular modeling is likely not only to facilitate faster design of new therapies for medical purposes, but may also yield improved catalysts for fertilizer manufacturing, to the invention of completely new materials, and to accelerated chemical prototyping for the development of more efficient batteries. Annually, the worldwide agricultural sector spends an estimated $170 billion on synthetic nitrogen fertilizers to enhance crop yields and to meet the growing demand for food. The Haber-Bosch process, responsible for producing synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, consumes approximately 1-2% of the world's annual energy supply, including 3-5% of the world's global annual natural gas production, and releases vast quantities of CO2, accounting for 3% of global carbon emissions. The ability to improve the production of nitrogen fertilizers through advanced quantum chemistry simulations has the potential to not only save billions of dollars annually, but also substantially reduce carbon emissions, promoting both environmental sustainability and global economic stability. Another key application area is in optimization. Our complex modern economy is awash with optimization challenges. Management of supply chains, route planning for delivery or logistical systems, and even traffic control are all examples of optimization problems which are becoming excessively complicated for classical computers to deal with. Whilst it might be easy to alter the train timetable if there is a problem with one of the tracks, how does this affect the connecting buses and ferries? There are similar complex optimization problems in finance, notably in risk estimation and portfolio optimization. What all complex optimization problems have in common is dependencies across large numbers of variables. Because of the inherent parallelism due to entanglement, quantum computers will be able to cope with problems of this nature much more effectively than classical computers. A final example worth mentioning is cybersecurity. Some of the earliest quantum computing algorithms suggested that quantum computers might be used to break the encryption that secures all our important information online. It is premature to worry on this front. Implementing these algorithms requires a quantum computer with a very large number of qubits and extremely low error rates, a product that is much more sophisticated than anything likely to be available in the next decade. Still, the threat has inspired security agencies to develop so-called quantum-resistant cyber protocols. While applications in this domain are probably a long way off, the power of quantum computers to crack encryption codes is of significant enough concern that this will be a space to watch. So, we already have a surprisingly large set of quantum applications on the table and ready to go, simply awaiting the invention of the right hardware. The big question, then, is not whether a quantum computer can work, or whether it will provide some advantage, or what the applications will be, but whether we can practically deliver the hardware to operate all these quantum algorithms. That's the challenge now. That's what the world is racing for. Everyone's waiting for the hardware. So, how do we build this? And more importantly, what is the best way to build it? Currently, there are several possible routes being pursued around the world. In our Australian company, Silicon Quantum Computing, which is the world leader for atom-based quantum computing in silicon, we are creating a quantum computer using the globally unique atomic manufacturing technology I've developed with my team at UNSW over the past 25 years. But you may have heard of other companies too. D-Wave, IBM, and Google are building their quantum computers with quantum bits made using superconducting junctions. IonQ is a company that is making quantum bits using ions of a rare earth metal called ytterbium. Xanadu makes quantum bits using photons of light. What all these companies have in common is that their quantum bits are constructed out of nature's fundamental building blocks, such as electrons, atoms, ions, photons, and superconducting metals. Going right down to these fundamental components is essential if you want to tap into the power of quantum mechanics. Nevertheless, each implementation is different, with its own pros and cons. For example, some of the first qubits were demonstrated in ionic systems because they're incredibly stable. But operating these systems is cumbersome. The time required to address and operate an ionic system is long. This is a materials technology that has never been manufactured at scale, where it will be extremely challenging to scale to high qubit numbers, numbers that will be needed to build a quantum computer that is actually useful. By contrast, if you read the news, you might have heard that the superconducting qubit companies are now in the lead based on raw qubit counts. The key advantage of these companies is that they were able to deploy rapidly using pre-existing 1990s manufacturing technology. They've had many incredible achievements, but this implementation too has its challenges. Because they are physically large, superconducting qubits are particularly prone to interference from their environment. This limits the time that a superconducting qubit can be held in a specific quantum state. Or, to use the technical jargon, they have what is known as a short coherence time. The makers of quantum computers based on superconducting qubits are now trying to control this using elaborate electronics. But, as they scale beyond a certain point, they face higher error rates and other engineering constraints, where their chips are now so large, they no longer fit in their ideal low-temperature operating environment. So, which system is the best? At this stage, no one truly knows. But the longer you can hold your material system in a specific quantum state, i.e. the longer its coherence time, the more stable and less error-prone your quantum computer is likely to be. But there's another thing that matters. How fast can you operate your qubit? It's not much use to have a long coherence time if you have a very, very slow operation time. This is the issue for ionic qubits. Ultimately, what really counts is how long you can maintain a specific quantum state and the speed with which you can perform operations on your quantum state. The higher that ratio, the better your system is likely to be, the more qubits you can build, and the more powerful your ultimate computer. This is one of the reasons I'm so excited about atom-based quantum computing. We have a very simple, elegant, and clean system. In our atom-based approach, quantum information is encoded on phosphorus atoms, either on the spin of a phosphorus electron or on the spin of a phosphorus nucleus. These phosphorus-based quantum bits are kept in place and protected by a silicon lattice, which is ideal since silicon naturally forms a low-noise crystalline environment. Significantly too, all the electronic components in the processor are made with atomically patterned phosphorus, from the control electrodes that create entanglement to the sensors that initialize and read out the information, as well as the qubits themselves. Everything, all together on one monolithic chip, is made up of just two elements, phosphorus and silicon. This brings huge advantages because it means we do not have the material interfaces and imperfections that are well known to cause defect states and to cause qubits to lose their information or decohere. Working with just two kinds of atoms enables us to form stable, high-quality qubits. That is not to say, however, that we don't have our challenges as well. For atom-based quantum computing, the biggest impediment has been technological. A quarter of a century ago, there was no off-the-shelf technology for us, as there was for superconducting teams. We had to start from scratch. Before we could exploit the quantum effects in our system, we first had to figure out systematically how to design and manufacture atomic-scale devices. And then we had to learn how to control the quantum states of individual electrons and of the nuclei of individual atoms within these devices. None of this was easy, but as I described in my last lecture, that's what we've done over the past quarter century at UNSW. Our globally unique atomic manufacturing technology enables us to make electronic devices where individual phosphorus atoms can be placed into a silicon substrate to create devices with atomic precision. This, on its own, is an extraordinary capability. But we've since gone on, steadily but surely, to exploit this technology to demonstrate all the key components of a quantum computer. In conjunction with our spin-out company, Silicon Quantum Computing, we've created quantum bits where information is encoded in a single electron on a single phosphorus atom. We've entangled quantum bits to form what is known as a two-qubit gate. We've gained exquisite control of a single electron spin so we can both initialize and read out the state of our qubits. We've developed the capacity to individually address two quantum bits with extraordinary accuracy, even though they are less than 10 nanometers apart. And most recently, we've engineered an integrated circuit where we've placed phosphorus atoms with such precision that they were used to simulate the quantum behaviors of electrons in an organic molecule. Our goal is now to produce a 100-qubit quantum processor by 2028. Will we get there? I believe we will. There are still big challenges ahead, but we have come up against a legion of serious challenges over the past two decades and found our way through. We have great people working on this, and I mean truly superb people, who have come from all over the world to join us. We also know what we need to do, which is a huge help. I'm a firm believer in roadmaps and milestones. Not all scientists work this way, but for an ambitious, multi-decadal experimental physicist, it is the only way to reach one's destination. And then there is the strength of our competitive position. Not only have we realized ways to input and read out information from individual atoms with higher accuracies, longer lifetimes, and faster speeds than others, but with our atom-based technology, we have established unequivocal international leadership. And we possess the know-how and patents that will be necessary to hold this lead. I believe that we can take this all the way. At the start of today's lecture, I mentioned the revolution in all our lives brought about by the invention of the transistor. In explaining how a quantum computer works, I've tried to give you a flavor of the promise of quantum computing and why I, together with so many physicists, believe that a quantum computer could produce a similar transformation not so far off in humanity's future. There is something important, however, that I hope will be different this time. The discovery of the transistor spawned several global industries: the semiconductor industry, the computing industry, the software industry, and all the modern digital industries we rely on today. While these are all global industries, each had its genesis in America. And I think there's little doubt as to why. In the early years, it was the Americans who invented the transistor and the integrated circuit. And it was the Americans who controlled the early industrialization of these technologies. Everything else followed. We don't know yet which implementation will ultimately prove the most effective for quantum computing. But if it turns out that our atomically engineered devices are the winners, then it could, surprisingly, be Australians who control the invention and the industrialization this time around. One thing we know is that whoever gets there first, a quantum computer is worth striving for. This is much more than just a gee whiz story about scientific discovery. It's much more than a technological breakthrough producing the potential for global transformation. It is an area in which, somewhat miraculously, Australia has emerged with unique potential. A potential not just to play the game, but to lead it. And this too is part of the quantum promise. Of course, we still have quite a road to travel. There are many unknowns. Ultimate success will require tremendous hard work, insight, technical prowess, and our fair share of good fortune. But the potential nonetheless is there. It is real if we are able to seize it.
Mind-boggling, and she distills it so well, I think. Michelle Simmons with her second Boyer lecture, The Quantum Promise. And in our next episode of Big Ideas, where we're bringing you the Boyer lectures, we're going to take you from the physics of quantum computing to the importance of imagination and mindset and doubt in science. A great listen, don't miss it. Each year, the ABC invites a distinguished Australian, in this case it's Michelle Simmons, to really inspire and challenge us with a series of four Boyer lectures. You know, they've been running for 64 years, which is pretty amazing, isn't it? You can find all the Boyer lectures via the ABC Listen app. Just find and follow the Boyer Lectures podcast. And while you're at it, be sure to follow Big Ideas as well. I'm Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.